This podcast is about correcting the balance, whether it's something celebrated as good when it shouldn't be, or the other way around. Or maybe the heroic tales of history just need to be knocked straight on their ass. Me? I just want to share the complete picture, because that's when this whole thing gets fun. Warning, jokes and sarcasm may ensue. Welcome to Prick the Balloon. Hi, I'm Mike Vance, and this is episode 13 of Prick the Balloon. It's also the first episode that comes with a prerequisite. It's the second half of the story of Woodrow Wilson, and spoiler alert, he dies. Seriously, you really should make sure you've heard episode 12 so you get a concept of where he came from and all that kind of touchy-feely, totally unprofessional psychoanalysis sort of shit. We left off with our hero, good old Bad Tooth Woody, newly remarried, newly reelected, and sternly telling the Germans to stop sinking American ships and killing Americans by the dozen, pretty please, mother may I, or I'll stomp my feet and stand in the corner and hold my breath. And then, in January 1917, Germany just gave the entire world two big middle fingers and said our new policy is unrestricted submarine warfare. Meaning, if it ain't ours, it's going down faster than an X'd-up Paris Hilton. Germany thought it had so much U-boat power that it could win the war before the United States came in. Plus, they were convinced that since Wilson won re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of war," they could just keep shoving him and taking his lunch money as long as they wanted. On March 1st, 1917, came the release of a telegram. And we have to go down a little espionage and technology pathway here. British intelligence was great, not just because of some really bitchin' movies and TV shows, or because Ian Fleming created both James Bond and Pussy Galore, but because at the start of August 1914, when war looked possible, the British cut all of Germany's underwater telegraph cables. Yeah, there were literally big-ass cables laid on the seafloor connecting countries and even continents. And those dastardly Brits cut 5 transatlantic cables and 6 more that connected the UK to Germany directly. So the Germans had to borrow other countries' cable lines, and those limeys had tapped into those. That meant when Germany wanted to talk with someone far away, Judi Dench was listening on the bedroom extension. But what about codes, you ask? Well, the Russians had fished a Navy codebook out of a dead German sailor's pocket and shared it with Britain, and British intelligence themselves sent fucking Michael Caine into some German dude's hotel luggage in Damascus or some such hotbed of intrigue and lifted the diplomatic codebook while the Jerry was having a gin fizz with Sidney Greenstreet and swatting flies, and for the rest of the war, the Germans are like, "Wilhelm, you magnificent bastard, I read your code!" One of the telegrams the Brits intercepted and decoded was from the German foreign minister, Arthur Zimmermann, to his ambassador in Washington. Because the direct German cables had been cut, they had to send it through Copenhagen, then a relay station in, wait for it, Western England. That's like asking your girlfriend to drop off a note at your side piece's apartment and hoping nobody figures anything out. Good Lord, Germans! The gist of this telegram was that Germany was making a big offer to Mexico to come in and help them fight the United States if the U.S. joined the war. They offered a bunch of cash, but the main thing was that Germany wanted to give Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico back to Mexico, which, if that happened today, might get a much different reaction from a majority of Americans. Not to mention the several million liberal Texans might enjoy being part of Mexico. Who knows? At the time, though, the American public was primo pissed off-o. Still, that pasty little girl Wilson failed to immediately act. But a couple weeks into March, after the Germans had sunk a bunch more American ships, the cabinet finally agreed it was time for war. And it was declared on April 6th, 1917. Wilson asked for a military draft and more money. While he didn't exactly have one of those "a day that will live in infamy" kind of lines, he did say, quote, "We are but one of the champions of the rights of mankind. We shall be satisfied when those rights have been made secure as the faith and freedom of nations can make them," end quote. Interesting little side note. The Secretary of War was the former mayor of Cleveland, this small, bespectacled dude named Newton D. Baker, who had been rejected for military service during the Spanish-American War because of his eyesight. He was an avowed pacifist, but seems to have been a really good guy. When he got made secretary, he told reporters, quote, "I don't know anything about this job," end quote. Kinda gotta love Newton D. Baker. As often happens when war comes to the United States, we were not prepared. They immediately conscripted the National Guard, then had to train them, so it took a little bit of time before the American doughboys were actually sailing across the pond. There were only 175,000 U.S. soldiers there by the end of 1917. The initial goal was 500,000 men in the National Army, but they eventually drafted almost 3 million. By the middle of 1918, 10,000 Yanks were getting off a boat every day. The term doughboy, by the way, dated back to the Civil War and came from cavalry troopers making fun of infantry. Could have been worse. They could have been collectively known as the Fat Jiggly Jaundice Boys, I guess. Or the Christies. One little teaser note for later. There were about 380,000 blacks in the U.S. Army during World War I, and more than half of them were sent to Europe. They primarily worked in the rear, doing things like longshoremen. The short version is that the Army itself was wanting more black units, and the commander of the American Expeditionary Force, John Pershing, who had been partying his way through Mexico the previous year, admired the abilities of black troops, and would have actually used them. Lots of the Army brass did not agree, but it was really Wilson and his allies in Congress who refused to let them fight. They didn't believe in the troops, but they also feared that if black soldiers came back from France as heroes, they'd expect better treatment at home. That's exactly what happened anyway, but we'll spend a lot more time on that in about 20 minutes. Now, the objective of war is generally to defeat the other side. That very, very often includes the idea of conquering new territory, a la coked-up Putin in Ukraine. But Wilson kept saying that he did not want any new territory for the United States. Woody was telling people that he was shooting for, quote, an organized common peace that would prevent future conflicts. You might immediately think of the phrase, the war to end all wars, and it would be easy to ascribe that nonsense to Woody Wilson, but it wasn't him. The war to end all wars, quote, comes from H.G. Wells in a London Times editorial in 1914. And that's kind of poetic and perfect, since horseshit like war to end all wars is just about as grounded in reality as time machines, an army of Martians invading the suburbs, and an evil sloth man. Anywho, in January 1918, Woody announced his 14 points. These were the things Woodrow wanted to get out of the war. As long as 116,000 Americans are going to be killed, we might as well have a solid set of goals, right, Woody? Now, a lesser and more orange man might ask the war genie for 3 dozen Big Macs and a urine milkshake, but Wilson mainly wanted to establish an association of all nations that would guarantee the future independence for all people. He talked about free trade, democracy, and self-determination. This whole League of Nations idea was pure D. Woodrow Wilson high-flown idealism. Presidential speechwriters love to talk about morning in America and 1,000 points alight, but Woody bought all this shit hook, line, and American shipping sinker. Let's put a pin in the league, though, until it actually happens. Just like happened in World War II, Wilson tried to set an example for thriftiness, more food for the troops sort of thing. There were signs and banners everywhere that said, "Food will win the war, don't waste it." The government pushed for Meatless Monday and Wheatless Wednesday, and both of those caught on, unlike Assless Chap Friday, which got a much cooler reception. And yes, I know they all are. It was a joke. Woody, and yes, remember he hated that name, kept a flock of sheep on the White House lawn as a show to the nation of saving labor and all that, which was very different than when Zachary Taylor kept a single sheep in a sundress ensconced in a butler's pantry. More about that in another episode, maybe. Meanwhile, Wilson raised taxes, an excess profits tax, and raised the top income tax rate to 77%. Just hearing that number of 77% made a big skid mark in Elon's shorts, didn't it? They still needed to borrow more money, so they raised war bonds. World War I did bring the first of these great posters for war bonds. A stern-looking Statue of Liberty buying bonds lest I perish. A hot-looking young woman in a flag dress dancing through the field sowing the seeds of victory. The most iconic American poster of all time also came from World War I. A top-hatted Uncle Sam pointing and saying, "I want you for the U.S. Army." And with that visual, let's go to the litany of bad shit. Because that's how we roll, all fair and balanced and Jerry Hall Dayton and whatnot. Wilson's advisor, Joe Tumulty, supported women getting the vote, but his boss did not. Even back when he was governor of New Jersey, Wilson was on record as saying women did not have enough experience to vote. But he left things up to the states, and a ton of states out west gave women the right to vote. In the South, they did not, because they were afraid it would give blacks more power. Let's just say that math, like spelling and teeth, have never been a strong suit in the South. When World War I started, some of the most vocal suffragettes, and one major who confused Paul McCartney, started picketing outside the White House. At first, Wilson was polite to them. He even waved. But within a few days, he decided that they were unfeminine, and he started having them arrested. Three groups of them, including the famous Alice Paul, got sent to workhouses on 60-day sentences. When they went on hunger strikes, they were beaten and force-fed. The protesters who followed them outside the White House got kicked and beaten by male onlookers while police stood by and watched. Finally, in 1918, Wilson changed his mind and came out in favor of a constitutional amendment to give women the vote, and he tied it to being vital to winning the war. Bottom line, he saw the proverbial graffiti tags on the wall. The first vote in the Senate lost by a margin of 2, and it didn't get approved until half a year after the war, when a few more senators got cut off from Waka Waka Woo. But it did become law in 1920, before Wilson left office. The biggest strike against Wilson early in the war is that he was just a flaming asshole. He shut down anyone who disagreed with him like they were a Saudi topless bar. He set up a propaganda office run by a guy named George Creel, who had been an investigative journalist. And related to what we just talked about, Creel was an advocate for women getting the vote. His office was in charge of creating those gorgeous posters I mentioned, but they also cracked down with all kinds of censorship. That included the journalists who eventually went to Europe with the army. Everything they wrote had to be favorable. The Wilson administration also cracked down on anyone with a German surname. The new laws required all non-naturalized German men over 14 who were in the United States to register as aliens. That meant a 4-page form with fingerprints and photographs. Their firearms were confiscated, and they were prohibited from working in certain restricted areas without further vetting and a permit. Wilson was worried about espionage and sabotage, but things went way beyond that. They included American women who had married German-born men. I ran a museum for a while in a heavily German part of Texas, and I know that in the collection were World War I alien cards for little grandmothers who had been living in Texas for more than 60 years. Like she was smuggling gunpowder in her corset and adding it to her wiener schnitzel gravy. And yeah, you bet your ass that's a euphemism. 480,000 German aliens were registered and 6,300 arrested under what were called presidential arrest warrants. If there was big money involved with the Germans, well, that was a different story. One of the most reprehensible people who ever held a major government job was this douche named Mitchell Palmer. He was a congressman from Pennsylvania, and he had this hard-set lower jaw that was just made for him to be a thug extra in an Edward G. Robinson movie. Wilson made him the alien property custodian, and basically just let him go to town. Wilson rammed two other laws through Congress in 1917, the Espionage Act and the Trading with the Enemy Act, and Palmer was enforcing them. The first one came with this lower-than-turtle-hurdles level of proof. The conductor of the Boston Symphony was falsely reported to have refused to play the national anthem, and that brought threats of lynching and got his German sausage-eating ass deported. The A.W. Faber Company had been making lead pencils since 1761, and that was one of the businesses Palmer confiscated. He closed down businesses worth a total of $500 million because they were suspected of trading with Germany. Part of the Faber Company had split off years early into Eberhard Faber Pencils, fully American, And it took personal intervention and lobbying before Wilson grudgingly stopped Palmer from closing them down too. Things as dangerous as beer were targets. Palmer tried to seize the Anheuser-Busch Company assets. He failed, but he did seize other German surnamed breweries. Some of the seized companies dealt in what could be termed war material, like the Bayer Chemical Company. Palmer seized not only the assets of those companies, but also their U.S. patents. He took 4,600 U.S. patents that belonged to German companies, and in the case of Bayer, that included aspirin, which was invented and patented by Bayer in 1899. When the war was over, the confiscated property was not returned. It got transferred to something called the Chemical Foundation, which in turn sold the patents at pennies on the dollar so they could be licensed to American companies. Both the Trading with the Enemy Act and the Espionage Act are still on the books. In modern times, the Espionage Act has been used against journalists, traitors, and political dissidents, including Daniel Ellsberg, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and straight-up dickweeds like the childish orange con man. There were movements in all this anti-immigrant hysteria to rename places called Germantown, and most of them were successful. German Street, Wieners, Sauerkraut all got new names, most involving the word liberty. Get this, there were people in the midst of this rabid xenophobia who seriously wanted to rename dachshunds because they hated Germans so much. People are fucking idiots. As the war was coming to an end in November 1918, the U.S. also had off-year elections. Wilson called on the voters to keep a Democratic majority in Congress and back his policies, but they did not. Oddly enough, some folks credit the Republican victories with them being able to win over the German Americans who Wilson had so thoroughly alienated, pun intended. And that set up Henry Cabot Lodge, this little pointy-beard senator from Massachusetts, as Wilson's arch enemy. Lodge had 4 degrees from Harvard, had written several history books. He was a protege of Henry Adams, who is a fascinating dude. Lodge had co-written a bill to guarantee voting right protections for African Americans back in 1890, but the bill got filibustered by Southerners. But before you get all these good vibes about Henry Cabot Lodge being all woke and shit, he also repeatedly pushed bills to restrict immigration from Italy and Southern Europe, which meant Italy. And when there was a mass lynching of 11 Sicilians in New Orleans, Lodge wrote an op-ed saying it was their own damn fault. Lodge hated swarthy Italians. Lodge had already been in favor of entering the war earlier and basically called Wilson an unprepared coward. So, the stage was set. With the end of the war came the Paris Peace Conference, and that was about to put the entire world into a century of shit. You can readily find famous pictures of Wilson at Versailles with the other big four leaders, David Lloyd George, Georges Clemenceau, and Vittorio Orlando, who later sang Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree. And Wilson is just towering over the other three guys. Wilson was like 5'10", 5'11", and the other three of the big four could have starred in Wizard of Oz for all we know. But people in Europe loved Wilson. They thought he was their savior. They turned out to see him by the freaking tens of thousands. Wilson went on this tour of Western Europe, fronted by Prince, and they were selling merch out of the backs of their van. It was rad. He was the first sitting president to travel to Europe, and since it took a few days to go back and forth by ship, that was sort of a big deal. He came home once in there for 2 weeks, but otherwise, Wilson was in Europe for 6 months. That is a long-ass time to stay away when your job is ostensibly running shit. He cut the Congress out of peace negotiations entirely. The moving parts of the American delegation to the Paris Peace Conference were Wilson, not really a Colonel Edward House, Secretary of State Robert Lansing, a diplomat named Henry White, who had been U.S. ambassador to both Italy and France under Roosevelt and Taft, and the Army Chief of Staff Tasker Bliss, who was this doppelganger of Terry Bradshaw, and I mean Terry Bradshaw right now. Then Wilson got sick. His doctor, Dr. Cary Grayson, thought it was the flu, and the flu was kinda going around at the time, to the tune of infecting an estimated third of the world's total population and killing off 50 million people. Wilson couldn't sleep. His digestion was all jacked up. He couldn't stop throwing up, to the point that he eventually brought up his swimming medal from the Indian guides. Then he fell asleep for 3 days. The notable part was that when Wilson woke up, first, he wanted to leave immediately and go home, but he changed his mind and decided to stay. He suddenly got all paranoid about the French servants being spies, even though most of them spoke virtually no English. He demanded that staff itemize the furniture in the house where he was staying because he was convinced it was being stolen. Ike Hoover, who was the White House chief usher, was there, and he even wrote about this stuff in his book. The worst part was that Wilson came out of the illness acting like an assholian schoolmarm toward the European allies. Clemenceau, the French leader who did have a sense of humor, took a shot at Wilson and the Brits at the same time. He said, quote, "I've never known anyone to talk more like Jesus Christ and act more like Lloyd George," end quote. Clemenceau also rather famously told Wilson that if he really wanted to win over the French people, he should send Teddy Roosevelt to negotiate. Hell, as it turned out, the corpse of Ben Franklin could have done a better job. All Wilson cared about was his League of Nations. He called it the keystone of the whole program. And he had this covenant of the League that included freedom of religion around the world and a permanent court of international justice. In the retroactively funny department, Japan wanted to add a clause that guaranteed racial equality. And Wilson was, of course, against this because, well, those people aren't like us. But Australia and Britain pushed for it, and Wilson eventually had to give in. Needless to say, it never actually worked anywhere. But because Wilson only cared about his precious league, he gave in to the French and British and Japanese on dividing territory that had belonged to the Germans. And the other allies wanted those Hun bastards punished, and punished hard. They agreed to let the French occupy the German Rhineland. They kept Americans and Brits walking around watching what the Germans were going to do, making sure they didn't come back and order shit at a Paris cafe. They made Germany admit that they started the war, and they had to pay a bunch of reparations that further wrecked their economy, and Germany had to give up all their overseas colonies so that they could be snatched up by the winning allies who were not named United States. Of course, this all went totally against what Wilson was saying about self-determination for all people. Perhaps the worst bits were cobbling together separate groups of people into these made-up nations of Czechoslovakia and especially Yugoslavia. The whole thing left the people in place, but invented these new national borders around them and subjected them to new governments. In other words, just throw them in the pit and tell them to get along with people who, in some cases, they'd been fighting for centuries. Croats, Serbs, Bosnian Muslims packed together in a clown car. What could go wrong? Not everyone bought this as being a good idea. Robert Lansing, the Secretary of State that Woody planned to run roughshod over, predicted that this bullshit will, quote, "raise hopes which can never be realized. It will, I fear, cost thousands of lives. In the end, it is bound to be discredited, to be called the dream of an idealist who failed to realize the danger until it was too late to check those who attempt to put the principle into force." End quote. The peace conference finished in May 1919, and that was the first time that the Germans, now with a new and improved democratic government, ever got to see the terms. Some of the German leaders wanted to just flat say no, but they signed the thing, and Wilson ended up getting the Nobel Peace Prize in 1919. But this whole thing planted the seeds for Hitler and World War II. Aside from the economic hit, this was off the charts embarrassing. It was like the French and English made the Germans drink a quart of Everclear and then had them run naked down the hall of mirrors with the 33 LP stuck between their ass cheeks. The U.S. Senate then had to ratify the treaty and agree to have the U.S. join the League of Nations. And the Senate, remember, is controlled by Republicans and Henry Cabot Lodge. Even my dog can figure out this will require compromise. But Wilson, he ain't having it. When he comes back to the United States, the Republicans in the Senate are steaming mad. Instead of negotiating with Congress like a leader, Woody immediately starts this colossal tour of the Western states, trying to drum up public support for the League of Nations, as opposed to Senate support that would actually make it happen. Lodge is willing to support a modified version of the treaty. Former President Taft is pushing a modified version, and they say so publicly. But it all comes down to Republicans not wanting the U.S. to play a big role in the world community. Lodge's modifications are actually called the Lodge Reservations. Someone had a sense of humor. The biggest objection from some of the Republicans is against Article 10, which is the mutual defense condition, exactly the kind of thing the orange goon raves on about when he tells his butt buddy Putin to go ahead and attack our NATO allies. A handful of the no votes are progressives, upset over the pro-colonization aspect of the treaty, but most are radical righties of the same cloth as the ones who still want the U.S. to leave the United Nations today. Finally, in March of 1920, Lodge has put together a coalition of two-thirds of the Senate to pass the treaty and join the League of Nations with 10 changes. Wilson then tells his supporters to vote no. In other words, he kicks the whole goddamn sandcastle down rather than have to admit what he worked on wasn't perfect. So in the end, the U.S. never joined Wilson's League of Nations, not because of Wilson's opponents, but because of Wilson himself. Now, lots of this had taken place while Wilson was out on his tour rallying public opinion. But while he was touring, he started having headaches and other health trouble, and he finally goes back to the White House, and just a few days later, on October 2, 1919, Wilson had a massive stroke. He emerged from it paralyzed on his left side. He lost partial vision in his good eye. He was confined to his bed for weeks, and the one neurosurgeon who came in to see him, a guy named, and I am not making this up for those of you who recall the old Miss America pageants, Burt Park, said the whole thing greatly affected Wilson's personality. Well, no shit, Doc. Park said Woody had, quote, disorders of emotion, impaired impulse control, and defective judgment, end quote. And no, there's not a record of President Wilson throwing ketchup against the wall. But he still had 17 months left in his presidency, and he remained in office. There he is, incapacitated. And of course, rumors started flying. President was bad sick, and nobody knew what was going on. So even before 24-hour electronic news and blogs, people are trying to fill in the void. One story was that old Woody had caught the SIF over there from some Parisian dame and was losing his noodle, to use the medical term. And they pointed to these metal bars that had been put up on the White House windows, with the inference that they were there to keep the crazy old man inside. Turns out the bars had been put up under Teddy Roosevelt because his kids kept busting out the windows playing ball on the White House lawn. What was really happening is that Tumulty, Edith, and Dr. Grayson were putting up a wall to hide how bad off the president really was. Edith would take papers into Wilson's bedroom and bring them back with notes in the margin like, "The president wants," or "The president says." People talked about her handwriting being like a 12-year-old's, and when it actually was Wilson's handwriting, it looked nothing like it had before. Edith would let cabinet members come sit in the adjoining room to Wilson's bedroom and then give verbal instructions about what old Woody wanted done. He was literally the man just behind the curtain. But laws were passing without the president even signing them. Appointments to government posts were being ignored. The U.S. needed an ambassador to Costa Rica. The British ambassador never got received or even a note or a letter. And finally, he took his happy ass back to England, presumably for some boiled eels. One of the biggest was that they needed a new Secretary of Commerce, and that languished for months. They finally appointed someone who turned the job down, then finally Edith and Grayson picked a guy without consulting Tumulty, and he was widely considered to be a complete baboon. Tumulty and the cabinet members were well aware that Edith was keeping him away from her husband, and that's where you get all of these stories about Edith Wilson being the president. Some of them were written with great admiration of how she was the first woman president and how that's so wonderful because she was a woman showing what women can do. But the bottom line is that is a pile of horseshit that would drown Gary Coleman. The best face to put on this is that she curated what matters Wilson would address. His advisors were always on hand wanting to get in and run the government, but she kept them out. Her goal was to keep Wilson alive. She, by everything that most credible sources say, plus reading the motives between the lines, tried to relay her husband's wishes, but she didn't bug him with what she considered the small shit, even though sometimes the small shit was really the big shit. Sometimes enormously big shit. The important part to remember is this was not Edith's job where it pertained to the nation. By shielding him and getting all pissy and unforgiving and trivial and petty and even cruel toward Wilson's advisors, Edith was actively hurting the United States. She forced out House and Tumulty to a large extent. Those had been Wilson's two closest advisors, but Edith didn't particularly like them, especially Tumulty. Edith Bowling Wilson wrote a memoir. It took her 11 or 12 years to get it released, and a ton of it is about things like visits from the King and Queen of Belgium or the furniture in Paris. And it showed that she was a small-town woman with small-town sensibilities to a great extent, not some evil Bond villain with an inscrutable cat on her lap. And one of the things that several of his biographers talk about is that for months, when Wilson was mostly housebound at the end of his life, Edith kept him from knowing a lot of what he needed to know. Throughout late 1919, Wilson's inner circle concealed the severity of his health issues. By February 1920, the president's true condition was publicly known. Secretary of State Lansing became the first to suggest that the VP take over, which prompted Edith Wilson to ask for Lansing's resignation. And it was true what she thought. Lansing had to resign because he had been trying to cobble together some sort of working government. On the one hand, you picture Alexander Haig in a spandex Nazi uniform screaming, "I'm in charge here," before bursting into springtime for Hitler and Germany. On the other hand, Wilson was wholly and completely incapable of performing his duties as president, and the country needed an executive branch. Lots of people expressed qualms about Wilson's fitness for the presidency at a time when the League fight was reaching its climax. And domestic issues like strikes, unemployment, inflation, the threat of anarchism, all of these things are going on. Of course, this led to the 25th Amendment to clarify the vice president succeeding the president, but that was no help at the time. So, who was the vice president during all this, and why haven't I mentioned him? It was a guy named Thomas Marshall, a really decent dude who had been governor of Indiana. He had passed child labor laws there and anti-corruption laws. He'd beaten back a state forced sterilization law. He was against capital punishment. Marshall pushed for all kinds of workplace safety laws, the kind of things OSHA does today, like mandating medical supplies on site and storm-rated windows and locomotives. Wilson took him on the ticket because Indiana was a swing state, but he never liked Marshall. And Marshall just kind of philosophically shrugged and took it. At first, he proposed a bunch of ideas to the president, but Wilson shot him down. After a time, Marshall quit even going to all the cabinet meetings. The relationship was described as functioning animosity. Some members of Congress encouraged Marshall to assert his claim to the presidency, but he never even tried to replace Wilson. Not surprisingly, Vice President Marshall was said to be the guy most kept in the dark because Edith Wilson, Ann Tumulty, and everybody else close to Wilson were afraid of their guy losing the power, whether he could exercise it or not. This was unprecedented, of course. Even James Garfield, when he had been shot and was lingering around, he was in control of his mental faculties. And there wasn't this pressing weight of dozens of major issues at the time either. Because, yeah, there was still a lot of shit going on. Joe Tumulty was the Wilson advisor who pushed the most for government programs to help the working man. He had been pushing these in June 1919 for Wilson to get after Congress to establish a federal employment agency, federal housing, old age pensions and health insurance, equal pay provisions, a federal minimum wage. And Wilson seemed to go along with the ideas, but after the stroke, he was in no shape to push any of it. And it went exactly nowhere. All of that stuff waited for either the FDR administration or, in the case of old age health insurance and equal pay, all the way to Lyndon Johnson. The biggest issue is that you had 3 to 4 million men coming out of the military with no benefits, no support mechanism, and those cartoon coin purses that you open and moss fly out. They were gladly paying on Tuesday for a hamburger today, but they're all jockeying for jobs, so there's strikes and race riots. Farm prices went down. Unemployment went up to 12%. And lots of this civil unrest got blamed on what has become the great American scapegoat, socialists and communists. And don't forget anarchists. There actually was violence caused by anarchists, who, when I was a kid, I imagined were like European versions of the Three Stooges. Shemp, by the way, he truly understood pathos. There was a series of mail bombs from April till June 1919. John D. Rockefeller, the mayor of Seattle, a former senator from Georgia whose maid actually got her hands blown off. But it turns out that the bomb makers were ultimately not that good at making bombs, so very few of them went off as planned. Add to this that the Spanish flu epidemic was still going on, So equate all this with how crazy people were during the height of the pandemic with bleach and horse dewormer, hoarding Charmin, and it all followed the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. So the paranoia was running high, to say the least. People were waving their proverbial pitchforks like somebody had just spotted a bacon burger in Vermont. It became known as the Red Scare, and the guy in charge by this time was none other than the alien property thug A. Mitchell Palmer, who by now had been appointed Attorney General. In June 1919, Palmer's fancy townhouse was targeted for one of those bombs, but the anarchist in question, a crazy man named Carlo Valdonacci, blew up the bomb and himself while he was still on the sidewalk out front. Bit of trivia. Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt lived across the street and felt the whole thing. In fact, Franklin said the earth shook within the loins of Eleanor's personal secretary. But Palmer took the opportunity to go after American leftists. This was personal, like Saddam and Bush's daddy. All free speech had already long been suspended. Eugene Debs, who got 6% of the popular vote for president in 1912, had gotten tossed in jail for speaking against the war. Emma Goldman, who was an anarchist activist who gave lectures on women's rights and once encouraged the assassination of a big-time industrialist, got thrown in jail, along with her lover, though presumably in separate cells, for 2 years for inciting people to avoid the draft. But in 1919, after she got sprung, Palmer had her rearrested and deported to Russia along with a bunch of other people. Goldman, by the way, had thought she was an American citizen for 38 years, but Palmer said that the rabbi that performed her marriage to the American was not properly certified. The press called the ship that took everyone back to Russia the Red Ark. From November 1919 to January 1920, he launched the Palmer Raids with the support of a kid lawyer from the Justice Department named J. Edgar Hoover. This is where Hoover got his start. It was called the Bureau of Investigation. Some of the targets were unions, and the notion of leftists in unions was already the narrative of the owner class, while the working class saw it more as like, oh, we'd like to actually get paid, have a day off, and not get killed. More than 10,000 people were arrested in the Palmer raids for being so-called radicals, and 556 of them foreigners were deported. What this was really all about was hatred of immigrants, something both Wilson and Lodge and most other Americans shared. Pull the ladder up behind you. You can tell that by the targets of the Palmer raids. Two Polish-language newspapers. In Manchester, New Hampshire, police and agents arrested everyone dancing at the Tolstoy Club. In Chicago, everyone eating at the Tolstoy Vegetarian Restaurant. And by the way, I warned you about those goddamn vegans. They nabbed the Lithuanian Socialist Chorus during their rehearsal in Philadelphia, and they picked up a bunch of Polish dudes in New Jersey who were collecting money for a funeral. In spite of everyone in America reading headlines about how wrong the Palmer raids were and how they'd overstepped, abused, and brutalized, old Mitchie Palmer didn't quit. In 1920, he warned everyone about a giant plot to attack the very bedrock of capitalism on May Day. It never happened. What did happen was a huge explosion on Wall Street in September 1920 that killed 40 people, but it was never solved. It was blamed on more Italian anarchists by most people, but Upton Sinclair put it down to an accident involving hazardous materials in the horse wagon that exploded. A bit far-fetched. And Warren G. Harding had the Soviets investigated. He found nothing except large hairy women who could really fling a shot put. There was some pushback from the courts, and even a tiny bit of grumbling from within the Wilson administration, but not much. Joe Tumulty supported the Palmer raid since he was the guy who pushed Wilson really hard to appoint Palmer in the first damn place. This was while Wilson was in Paris and couldn't give two shits about what else was going on besides his precious League of Nations. Wilson later said no one told him what Palmer was doing, but given the way things were at the time with Wilson's health, who the hell knows for sure? What we do know is that the raids happened on Wilson's watch, and that no one ever stopped that fascist shit. Prohibition came in under Wilson, but his administration didn't really have jack shit to do with it. The 18th Amendment passed Congress, got ratified by the states, and that was it. Wilson did veto the Volstead Act, which was the enforcement law for it, but his veto got overridden. And he died before he ever got to see Robert Stack play Elliot Ness. So that's really sad. Wilson never did recover from his stroke. He spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair, although a few times he was able to stand on his own and shuffle a short distance using a cane. In spite of the fact that Wilson was pretty much incapacitated or all head up like Dr. Strangelove, he wanted to run for a third term in 1920. The Democrats didn't see it that way and nominated James Cox, governor of Ohio, with Franklin Roosevelt as vice president. Wilson vehemently opposed Cox. He also opposed his own son-in-law, William McAdoo. He wanted to keep being president, which is beyond delusional at this point. And that's just weird, right? Who could ever imagine having a president who was delusional and didn't want to leave, and fat and sweaty and orange and leering after his own daughter and cheating at golf and committing treason and attacking our national allies and maybe getting peed on by some Russian hooker and... I'm winded. Cox and Roosevelt got their asses handed to him. Warren G. Harding got over 60% of the popular vote and 404 of them electorals. Wilson and Edith bought a townhouse in Washington. He formed a law firm and then literally showed up one day. Never came back again. Harding died of a heart attack in August 1923 and Wilson went to the funeral, but he himself was dead less than a year later. He's the only president buried inside Washington, D.C., and he's buried in the National Cathedral, in a church, just to make sure no one has any meaningful fun near his grave. One interesting thing that I want to bring up here. In 1922, Wilson was still confined to his house, for the most part. Crowds of people are praying every day across the street and all that. And there was a dinner to endorse James Cox, the guy who had lost the election in 1920 by having his entire ass taken off of him, but who was still angling to be the nominee again in 1924. Tumulty and some others came to Wilson and asked for a message of endorsement to be read at this dinner. And Wilson, who was one petty and egotistical son of a bitch to the bitter end, gave the notion a flat no. Well, Wilson was scouring the papers still every day, totally absorbed by politics, and he was surprised to see stories that mentioned a message of endorsement was read to Cox from former President Wilson. So he summoned Tumulty to get to the bottom of this horseshit. And I should add that Wilson was already pretty pissed at Tumulty because Tumulty had released a book the previous year called Woodrow Wilson as I Know Him. Nothing scandalous. In fact, it's pretty boring. Inside politics drivel. But nonetheless, Wilson's panties were tied in quite the little knot. Well, when Tumulty finally gives an answer that, sure, Wilson said no to the endorsement, but Tumulty thought that pettiness made Woody look bad, so he took the liberty of writing up a little something-something to be read at the dinner. And that was the end between those two close friends. Tumulty was no longer welcome at the Wilson house, and he never was to darken his towels again. But let's talk real legacy, which for me, with Wilson, comes down a lot to weighing all of his accomplishments in changing the U.S. for the better, and as we discussed, especially in the first episode on the guy, there were a bunch. But you have to weigh that against his record on race relations. How much of a bigoted piece of shit was this guy? Well, the answer is so much so that it's rather mind-boggling. He had written back in his academic days about Italians being, quote, men of the lowest class, end quote, and Poles being men of the meaner sort. But he backtracked on that once he was president. With African Americans, there was no backtracking. And I gotta say something here. You cannot view history through your own personal modern lens. Times were vastly different, and what seems like really obvious righteous choices to us might be something that never even occurred to someone a few hundred years ago. Clearly, slavery and Jim Crow are horrible wrongs. But what sets Woodrow Wilson apart for me is not that he didn't do anything to make these things better. It's that he, more than any other president we ever had, except maybe Andrew Johnson, who was never elected in the first place, actively and gleefully took things backwards. He wadded up the tiny progress that black Americans might have made, and at the point that he took office, it was freaking tiny, believe me, smaller than T-Rump's hands, and he threw that progress in the trash. In his academic history writings, Wilson was an apologist for slavery. He was one of the very top promoters of the Lost Cause mythology that makes slack-jawed cousin jumpers who think Walmart corn dogs are haute cuisine also slur on about the Civil War not being caused by slavery. Some of that rhetoric lies with Woody Wilson. I already talked about some of this stuff earlier, but know that several of his cronies later wrote that Wilson, quote, loved to tell darky jokes, end quote. Wilson screened Birth of a Nation in the White House. That's the movie that caused a resurgence of the Klan in the middle 1910s, and if that's not enough, the filmmaker D.W. Griffith quoted Wilson on three of the movie slides. This was a silent film, of course, including one that said, quote, "At last there sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan, a veritable empire to the South, to protect the Southern country," end quote. That's the president who had written that in his History of the American People, and Birth of a Nation was the second movie ever screened at the White House. The first was also done by Wilson and his family. So how is that for some sad and disgusting trivia? But let's talk real results, not just private opinions. The only thing on the plus side of the ledger is that Wilson was against lynching, but at least one of his biographers believed that was because he thought it made America look bad abroad, not because he saw a horror in the violent deaths of black Americans at home. In the 1870s and 80s, and in some places up to the 1890s, there were blacks being elected to offices like local sheriff and tax collector, all the way up to congressman, senator, and in one case, governor. But in the 1910s, thanks to poll taxes and biased literacy tests and outright violence, lots of violence, that was pretty much over. All the black citizens could hope for if they wanted to go into government was an executive appointment. Wilson appointed a total of 9 blacks to prominent government posts, and 8 of those were reappointments of people already on the job. To compare, William Howard Taft, just before him, took a world of shit from his fellow Republicans for only appointing 31 blacks, since that was the lowest total since the Civil War. As soon as he took office, Wilson fired all but 2 of the 17 blacks in supervisor positions who had been appointed by Taft. Wilson told his cabinet secretaries that they were free to segregate the workforces within their offices. That had not previously been the policy. Within a year, that was done at Treasury, Navy, and the Post Office. Some said they didn't have the facilities to create a separate workspace for blacks, so they just fired them or forced them into early retirement. That applied to black veterans who came home from France to find they were not allowed back into their government jobs. Under Wilson, the Civil Service Commission started requiring photos with job applications, so lots of blacks never even got an interview in the first place. An impact study in the Quarterly Journal of Economics in 2021, and yes, I read that a lot in the bathroom, found that during the Wilson administration, the black civil servants got pushed into lower-paying positions, and the wage gap between black and white government employees widened by almost 7%. Those employees' rate of home ownership went down. Wilson appointed the first white consular representatives to Haiti and Santo Domingo since 1863, the same year as the Emancipation Proclamation became official. In the Army, black officers who were already in place prior to Wilson got forced out in a lot of cases. That changed once World War I started, but the units remained segregated, and there was a policy to cut the lower left-hand corner on African-American draft cards so draft boards and white officers could tell what was coming. The U.S. Navy had never been officially segregated, but you remember from the last time that Navy Secretary Josephus Daniels was one of the most vocal racists in America. He simply adhered to a policy that black soldiers were relegated to mess stewards, coal shovelers, or janitors. The cafeterias and restrooms in the Navy were segregated. In 1919, under Wilson and Daniels, the Navy just flat quit accepting black recruits, and that lasted until 1932. Daniels, by the way, was the first Republican choice to give the State of the Union rebuttal this year, but then they found out he was dead and shit. Turns out it wouldn't have mattered. There was one happy little story involving the Golden 14, not to be confused with the Golden 13 group during World War II. I know, it's very confusing. There were 14 African-American women who got brought into the Navy through a pretty sly bit of misdirection. A very light-skinned black man named John T. Risher, one of the supervisors that managed to survive, got to hire 14 also very light-skinned women to handle duties in the muster roll department in Washington. One woman was his sister-in-law, and he snuck these hirings right under the noses of his superiors. These women became the first black women ever to serve in the United States Navy. So, up yours, Josephus. They had, by the way, the rank of Yo Women, which I think somehow morphed into a Village People song years later. The sad fact is that all of the slaps in the face to these returning black soldiers sparked deadly race riots in East St. Louis, Chicago, and Omaha, but the Wilson administration just stayed out of them. The only action they really took was one within the Army relating to the riot in Houston, which is the only race riot in our history that killed more whites than blacks. That ended up with 118 soldiers court-martialed, 110 convicted, 19 executed, and placed into unmarked graves. There was an editorial cartoon that ran after the big riots in East St. Louis with a black woman looking up at Woody and saying, "Mr. President, why not make America safe for democracy?" To reiterate, history has to be viewed in context. Y'all have heard me say that many times if you've listened to other episodes. This is not George Washington or Jefferson, where slavery was the accepted practice of their neighbors. This was someone actively taking race relations in the United States backwards. His two immediate predecessors, Teddy Roosevelt and Big Bill Taft, had been pretty ambivalent at best about the start of Jim Crow and the erosion of all those civil rights that had emerged in the 1870s. But Wilson was actively working to make things worse for black Americans. And if you view things in that way, I think Woodrow Wilson should be the most harshly judged president we have ever had in terms of race. But what do other historians, the big academics like Wilson, think? The most recent study was the one that came out at the start of 2024 and got Orange Jesus all foamy mouth for being a distant last. They rated Woody at number 15. That's one behind Joe Biden and one ahead of Ronald Reagan. The interesting thing is that both Wilson and Reagan, and that's Reagan's middle name, by the way, have dropped 5 places in the last 6 years. He was ranked a little higher in studies by C-SPAN and Siena University. Of course, Siena also had Maryland winning the Big Ten, so come on. Lots of historians point to Wilson as laying the groundwork for modern liberalism and influencing the real liberals like LBJ, Truman, and FDR. Things he did like the Federal Trade Commission, a graduated income tax, and especially the Federal Reserve continue to be positive influences on the country today. If you like the old premise about what the opposition says about you, George Will, who is another bone-dry baseball fiend like old Woody, calls Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson the, quote, progenitors of today's imperial presidency, end quote. But what about non-historians, huh? The Princeton School of Public Affairs carried Wilson's name until 2020, when the Board of Trustees voted to remove it. Still, lots of monuments and foundations remain named after Wilson, including one in Prague, which is rather inexplicable to me. I don't know. But I'll leave you with two interesting facts. In 1944, Daryl Zanuck, who was one of the most important producers and studio heads in Hollywood history, wanted a movie about Woodrow Wilson because he loved and admired the man. So he did this biopic called, very cleverly, Wilson. It got 10 Oscar nominations and actually won 5. But as big a film fan as I am, I had never even heard of this turkey. It lost $2 million at the box office, which in 1944 was real money. Zanuck produced Streetcar Named Desire, Gentleman's Agreement, All About Eve, and 12 O'Clock High. He knew pictures, but when it came to picking presidents people wanted to watch, Zanuck didn't know shit from Shinola. Even Josh Brolin as George W. made a profit, though it did open behind Beverly Hills Chihuahua. Bottom line, that Wilson movie was in 1944, and nobody has ever attempted to make a movie about the Woodster since. And one other. I've dropped hints before that Nixon had his moments, so you might find this interesting. Nixon's favorite president, the guy he idolized, was Woodrow Wilson. His talk about a just and lasting peace in Vietnam was patterned after Wilson. Ignore the fact that neither achieved it. Nixon loved Wilson so much that he had his portrait hanging in the Oval Office, and he had Wilson's desk brought in to use. Nixon loved to put his feet up on Wilson's desk and imagine that he was doing what Wilson did. He did it so much that eventually he started to leave heel marks. Once, while Nixon was on an overseas trip, an aide had the desktop refinished, and Nixon was not at all pleased. Hey, I've got a Patreon page for those who like getting some exclusive inside commentary and content, but mostly it's for people who might see some value in what I'm creating and are willing and able to subscribe and support my efforts. It's been taking me about 3 days to put together each of these podcast episodes, and one of the hardest things to convince people of is that creators, people who love what they do, still have bills to pay. So I'm just tossing the mention out there. If you can't afford it, I totally understand. Sincere thanks for listening, and please don't stop. The last couple of months, I've made a couple of exclusive little short videos of me sharing one of my old show business stories that are just for Patreon. They're fun to do, and hopefully the subscribers think that too. It's patreon.com/MikeVance. Anyway, as I'm about to repeat in the produce close, thanks to every single one of you for your support, and thanks for listening. All of y'all are great. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out my website at MikeVanceWriter.com. Prick the Balloon is copyrighted by Mike Vance, all rights reserved.